This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
You gotta be frustrated. I know. I can taste it. Frustrated by high prices, by gridlock in Congress.
That is Joe Biden, who claims that he knows the frustrations of Americans right now. Now, I don't believe him because I don't think he knows what's going on in his own country. We've got tens of billions of dollars going to a foreign war that we're not even directly involved in. And virtually everybody agrees we wouldn't be involved in it at all. And Russia might not have even invaded Ukraine if Donald Trump were still president of the United States and we didn't have this fool in the White House who screwed up Afghanistan and the exit from that country so badly. With inflation, which now everybody is celebrating today because they say it's no longer running at a 40-year high, it's more like a 38 or 39-year high. Well, that's so much better. And crippling gas and diesel prices and a faltering economy. And now, get this, now Americans have a brand new frustration. The most powerful country on planet Earth cannot make enough baby formula to feed the babies in America. And I'm going to tell you why there's evidence to believe that at least in part, an evil government bureaucracy known as the Food and Drug Administration is to blame for a big part of that shortfall. And if you're suffering under that shortfall, I'd like to hear from you. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show, the best conversation in talk journalism. It's honestly provocative talk, and you're welcome to join in that conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Another way to participate, vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that two places, Twitter, of course, at Lars Larson Show. And if you can't tolerate Twitter, go to my website. The vote counts the same there, LarsLarson.com. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for these past 22 plus years, and glad to keep right on serving the region every single day. Now, let me tell you why I blame the federal bureaucracy of the Food and Drug Administration for what's going on. And I'll give credit where it's due. The Daily Mail, which is a newspaper now online and out of Great Britain, but they do excellent coverage of America, not just politics in America, but issues like this one. And they ask the question, why is the single biggest baby formula plant in all of the United States of America? Why was it shut down 3 months ago? And why is it still shut down today? And the short answer is FDA. The plant is run by a company that a lot of us are familiar with called Abbott Labs. They, in fact, make the sensor that's on my arm that tells me what my blood sugar is. So if you think I have a dog in the fight, other than that, I've got no financial involvement with Abbott Labs. But Abbott Labs runs the single biggest baby formula plant in America. It's in Sturgis, Michigan. It was shut down 3 months ago. And for no apparent good reason, the FDA refuses to reopen that plant, even as parents. And a lot of these parents are understandably spooked by what's going on. They go to the stores and they find empty shelves where ordinarily there are stacks and stacks and stacks of baby formula. In fact, last fall, Tina and I had a friend of the family who had a brand new baby, and they had run out of formula. And the baby was on, as a lot of babies are, on a particular kind of formula that didn't upset the baby's stomach. We literally got in the car and we drove miles and miles and miles to about half a dozen different stores and found four cans of baby formula. So there have been shortages before, but nothing like what is going on right now. Now let's get back to the plant in Michigan. Abbott Laboratories says that they were wrongly accused of being involved in some infections, bacterial infections that killed at least two infants. So they recalled a bunch of their product. They shut their plant down. The FDA came in, and the FDA investigation, according to Abbott, revealed, quote, infant formula produced at the Sturgis facility is not the likely source of infection. Now, obviously, with infection, as we've all become too painfully aware over the last 2 years, you can't always say absolutely anything about any kind of infection. But Abbott says the products from the facility didn't cause the bacterial outbreak. But it was good that they double-checked. The plant is still closed. It was shut down back in February amid a major product recall. So you had all this product being pulled off the shelves out of an abundance of caution and then destroyed. You had the plant shut down. And they're working with the FDA, but the FDA has no explanation as to why they're keeping the plant shut down. And they say, our plant isn't responsible. You shut us down 3 months ago. You won't let us operate. And the United States of America is short of baby formula. Now, I've got a theory on this. I have a friend who's an academic today, Dr. Henry Miller, and we cite him all the time, and you hear him as a guest on this show. He used to work at the FDA. And you have to understand there is a perverse thing that happens in government bureaucracies. He has told me so many times, in fact, going all the way back to the 1980s, when they first approved synthesized insulin. Before the 1980s, we had to get insulin if you were a type 1. I don't happen to be a type 1 diabetic, but if you were a type 1, they got insulin a crude, old-fashioned way. They took organs, you know, pancreas, from pigs and steers and other animals, and they literally ground them up and extracted the insulin. And they were literally running out. They didn't have enough insulin to supply the growing needs of America. So they said, we got to figure out how to synthesize this. When private companies figured out how to do it, they then had to go hat in hand to the FDA and say, would you please approve this? And the minute you do, it's going to fulfill a human need right now, kind of like the baby formula problem that's going on right now. And you know what the FDA did? Henry, at the time, Dr. Miller, worked for a bureaucrat. And that bureaucrat, they looked at all the data from the companies and said, okay, we've studied the data and all the results. This stuff is safe. And by the way, it's the stuff that people who are diabetic are using today. And his boss said, no, we're not going to approve it. It's too soon because we've only spent 5 or 6 months looking at this data. And here's what happens to bureaucrats. If a government bureaucrat delays something and says, we're going to take a year, maybe 2 years or 3 years to approve something. If it turns out that approving it was the wrong decision and people get hurt or people die, at least the bureaucrat can cover his own backside by saying, well, we studied it for 2 years and we did our due diligence. If instead they approve it in 3 or 4 months, even if the data is right there in front of them, if something goes wrong, the bureaucrat gets in trouble. I think that's what's going on right now with the FDA. The FDA is saying, we're going to do this out of an abundance of caution. If it takes 6 more months to reopen that plant in Sturgis, Michigan, so what? There's a baby formula shortage. All those families will just have to suck it up and figure out another way to feed their babies. The government bureaucrat wants to cover his own backside, and I think that is just downright evil. An awful lot of us, after the pandemic of the last 2 years, don't trust the FDA, don't trust the CDC, don't trust Dr. Fauci, and we certainly don't trust the government to make medical decisions for us. Well, right now, if you're out there looking for baby formula for somebody in your family and you can't find it on the shelves, I just want you to know the FDA is behind at least a big part of it. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Coming up in a moment, should we put the Democrat Party on political suicide watch? I'll make that case coming up next. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Quick! Somebody put the Democrat Party leadership on political suicide watch. Today, the U.S. Senate votes on a bill so crazy that no one, not even the Democrats who are proposing it, expects it to pass. And it exposes the extreme agenda of America's Democrat Party, the party of slavery since the early 1800s. You see, for 50 years, we've heard liberals scream that abortion is the law of the land. Well, the Supreme Court has made big mistakes before, and as always, it eventually corrects them. Now, the Supreme Court is ready to correct the deadly mistake of Roe v. Wade that has taken 60 million innocent lives over the last several decades. That has liberals running around like their hair's on fire. So, they've decided to introduce, in today's Senate vote, the most extreme pro-abortion law you could ever imagine. If they could actually pass it, which seems almost certain to fail as of today, and if it got through the House, and if it got to Joe Biden, because he'll sign anything they put in front of him as long as he gets ice cream after lunch, it legalizes every single abortion under all circumstances right up to the very last second before that baby is born. Public opinion polls show the public has no stomach for that kind of extremism. But when liberals have lost their minds, as they appear to have done, that's exactly what they do. So, Senator Chuck Schumer plans to go down in flames with a failed vote today that makes a permanent record of just how extreme his party can be on the subject of life. And he's doing it in an election year when it might actually cost some of the Democrat Party senators their jobs in the U.S. Senate. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's a good thing. There's a plus to that. So make some popcorn and enjoy the show. We haven't seen a kamikaze run like this one since Admiral Yamamoto was running the Japanese Navy. On Twitter, I got this comment, unsigned. So I guess we can assume that Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is still breastfeeding. I presume he hasn't noticed the formula shortages. No, because it is about supply chain as well. And this one from Barbara, our question of the day. Lars, I attended a Take Back America group meeting last night to watch 2,000 Mules. Great documentary. I saw it this weekend. I've told you the pluses and minuses. Hopefully you've had a chance to see it. Yes, Barbara, I have. After the movie, a discussion ensued regarding the ballot in Clackamas County and the plan on how they intend to correct them. You see, they came up with a printing error that screwed up a bunch of the barcodes, so they say they're going to handle them by hand. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? How could they cheat in that kind of situation? I understand that the ballots that are rejected will be hand counted by two people without much oversight. Do you know anything about it? A very concerned patriot, signed Barbara. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give two grills today. Number one, turnout in the Oregon primary stands below 10% and could end up the lowest in modern history, despite all the promises that vote-by-mail increases voter turnout. And secondly, as one of my emailers suggested, Rhino Cliff Benz. I never thought of Cliff Benz as a rhino. He's a Republican congressman from the 2nd District who voted for the $40 billion for Ukraine. I'm going to have to ask Congressman Benz to come on the show and explain why he would vote for such a thing. And then there's this from our email, our best email of the day so far. You can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Tony Bocci writes in, Lars, well, I'm with you that there are very few climate activists that walk the walk. The only famous person I can think of is the actress Daryl Hannah. I've read that she lives in a 1,500-square-foot or so home, grows her own food, takes the bus most everywhere, and generally doesn't fly. That is the true believer that walks the walk. I'd asked the question the other day, are any of these celebrities who talk about climate change, are they actually doing what they're suggesting the rest of us do? She may be one example, and if so, she's doing something admirable. On the phone with me right now is Frank Manning, who's with Diversified Marine Inc. Frank, I want you to tell my audience about what you alerted us to. Is it really the case that the state of Oregon is going to send $10 million to a company that's tied into the Russian government?
Hey, Lars, how's it going? Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
Yeah, that is the case. There's a program in Oregon Department of Transportation called Connect Oregon. It goes to non-highway transportation projects. This year there's one that's particularly abusive of the program. They're going to send $10 million to a company called Simolia. They manufacture mobile boat lifts, and they've chosen to do this over the American-made option. This company is connected with a company called Konar over in Russia. And Konar is so big that last October, Putin actually put out a press release from his office congratulating Konar on 30 years in business. And then the Italian director of Italian entrepreneurs working in Russia called the joint venture between Simolia and Konar the most successful Russian-Italian joint venture. So it's not weak ties, and it's a direct use of taxpayer dollars going to a company that has very strong ties to Russia. And
they're going to do this instead of buying from the American company Marine Travel Lift System. Do you, you're in the business. You're in the business. So you may have a dog in the fight. And if you want to say so, go ahead. But tell me, do you have some inkling as to why they would go with the Russian company instead of the American company?
I honestly, I can't explain that. Marine Travel Lift forwarded me an email where they reached out to Bob Dorn and Gordon Smith asking to be involved in the project. They've had electric lifts of this type in the market for 8 years basically got a no from them, not interested. And they had never reached out, never looked at the American-made option. So,
And no reason that, you know, the American-made option doesn't work as well or it costs too much money. I mean, those are usually the reasons that a bureaucracy would go with one instead of the other, unless, of course, there's something else going on. Do you have any idea what it might be?
I don't have any idea. I don't want to draw any conclusions on that. But if you look around at all the private marinas, shipyards around the country, they all use Marine Travel Lift. It's the most common brand here. This is an oddball kind of one-off company that just started making these a couple of years. So it's definitely curious why they're going with this option and why the state is set to move forward with that tomorrow.
And by the way, Frank, I know somebody's going to ask me this. Is there a big difference in the price of buying the American-made versus the Russian-made?
I don't have quotes from both. I know this one's $10 million. Marine Travel Lift indicated that they'd be in the same ballpark.
So, yeah, which is all you really expect. And you know, this is where when a lot of us say that we loved Donald Trump for putting America first, if the price is about the same and it's the functionality is the same, then why would you ever go and use something else? That's Frank Manning from Diversified Marine. Frank, thanks a lot for coming on. If you have any more information on that, I'd love to dig into that one. Coming up, how does it become so dangerous that people working for a county health clinic say they're being attacked in their workplace? We'll get to that next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to be with you. Our Twitter poll today, did Oregon lawmakers do the kids any good by legalizing possession of cigarettes and vapes? Believe it or not, they did it. I'll get you the details a little bit later. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at Ultimate Truck service.com. Now, we've all heard the perfect storm that we're in right now. Massive inflation, gigantic energy prices, shortage of baby food, for God's sake, baby formula. And then, of course, we've got the dangers in American cities. And here in the Pacific Northwest, stories out of Seattle where court workers are afraid to go to the King County Courthouse because there's so much chaos going on the streets. Amazon actually pulled 1,800 of its employees out of downtown Seattle. And in Portland, downtown Portland has become very, very toxic. And our friend Aaron Mesh, the news editor from Willamette Week, is here to talk about a story involving a county health clinic where the workers are literally discussing whether or not they need to wear bulletproof or stab-proof vests to work. Aaron, welcome back to the show, and tell me about this story that people can find at WWeek.com.
Well, it's good to be here, Lars. So Sophie Peel, our City Hall reporter, obtained internal Multnomah County documents that show the security risk assessment performed on behalf of the county about a building called the Gladys McCoy Building. It's the central health center, the health clinic for the county. It's intended to provide healthcare services to the most vulnerable people in the city. A lot of those people struggle with addictions. Some of them have HIV. Many of them are homeless. What the documents show is that the security risk assessment said that the single biggest security risk to people entering and exiting the building was, in fact, the people living in unsanctioned tent camps that surrounded the building. And it wasn't simply that they were campers that was the problem. It was the amount of illicit drug use, the amount of violence, the regular shootings, stabbings, and threats to the people who work inside this health clinic.
I mean, because, Aaron, a lot of this to conservatives seems like, well, duh. You know, how smart do you have to be to say if we allow people who are addicted to drugs, who may have to supply that addiction with illegal activities, including violent crime, if we allow them to congregate on the streets and then we provide a clinic that's supposed to serve those very people, that they're going to be dangerous to not just county health clinic workers, but everybody else as well. And they know this is the problem. So they paid $8,500, according to Sophie's story, for a security consultant. Did he have some brilliant suggestions for how to fix this?
Well, I mean, the suggestions ranged from providing more security personnel and, in fact, bulletproof vests to employees, to building a new parking structure and creating a walkway between the parking, suspended bridge between the building and the parking garage, which seems rather infeasible and doesn't exactly pass the Occam's razor test of the easiest way to solve the problem. I think what interests me about this story, you correctly state that few conservatives listening to this broadcast would be surprised by any of this or find it difficult to wrap their minds around. What I think is most interesting, though, is that the workers inside these clinics, these are people who dedicated their lives to the work of trying to make life incrementally better for people who are extremely poor, often addicted, and living outdoors. And they express over and over in these documents that Sophie obtained their fear that they are going to die on the job. And there's this cognitive dissonance that happens when people are saying, I don't want to call the police because I think the police will hurt my clients. And then they also say, but I'm afraid my clients will hurt me. And so cognitive dissonance.
But doesn't that sound like baloney to you? Aaron,
I'm not here to evaluate the thinking of the people who work inside these buildings. They do a hell of a lot more than I do for people who are hurting.
I get that. But when they say we're afraid to have the police come and perhaps take somebody into custody, which sometimes has to be done by force, not very often. I mean, the police have something like 400,000 contacts a year with citizens. And I think 8,000 or 9,000 of those out of 400,000 turn into any kind of use of force at all, let alone using deadly force. So but this idea that even the people working within the system don't trust the cops. Where's all that coming from?
Well, we did have 100 consecutive days of protests in the city that essentially said, like, the police are verboten. Remember that. So, like, it wasn't just a few radicals who felt that way. There was a large feeling among the citizens of Portland that
I disagree with you.
I think that there is a large spread feeling among a lot of Portland citizens that calling the police is essentially being a collaborator of some kind.
See, except that, Aaron, when you judge the point of view of almost 700,000 people in a city and almost 2 million people in a metro area, speaking of Portland, or 4 million in the Seattle area, and you say, we're going to take the temperature of those, 2 million people based on a few hundred mostly violent, so-called protesters, rioters, I don't think you take the temperature of an entire city based on a few hundred yahoos, most of whom are committing crimes themselves.
Well, sure, and I'm not like looking to do a poll of them, Lars, but you did ask me why this cognitive dissonance might exist within county workers, and so I answered your question.
Yeah, I think it's because they subscribe to a lot of liberal points of view that somehow they're in the system, but the other people in the system, who also the cops, are just doing their jobs, and if you say, how should you handle an out-of-control, drug-addicted person living on the streets who knows that he, mostly he, some she, face no criminal consequences for committing crimes to the largest degree? How should you handle them? And you go, well, with kid gloves, of course. Well, once the criminals, you know, because let's face it, if you're shooting drugs on the streets, it is still technically illegal, although ballot measure 110 pretty well cleared any kind of penalties off. But if you tell people you can do all this illegal stuff, and when you steal stuff, you're not going to be arrested and you're not going to be prosecuted, and you're not going to go to jail. Do you expect to get more of that kind of activity or less? Well, you're going to get more. And when it starts hurting people, you know, the very people who say don't trust the cops are the people who want to be saved by the cops. That's my cognitive dissonance.
Well, it's good that we both have one.
Well, okay, so what are they planning to do short run? Buy bulletproof vests and say good luck and we hope you don't die on the job?
Well, I think that here's an irony that these workers have a union, and that union is increasingly unhappy about the conditions that their workers are laboring in. I think that another tension that this story raises is that at some point fairly soon, AFSCME is going to start demanding. They haven't said this specifically, and of course they'll get mad by me saying it, but who cares? I think AFSCME wants homeless sweeps, right? Like I think they want to see a lot of these camps moved away from this building, and I think that that's something that a lot of their members secretly are looking forward to. Again, I'm trying to delineate the points of tension between people's worldviews inside this city. It makes for interesting copy.
Well, one last comment, Aaron. The very unions that say you can't put our workers in this situation are the same unions that helped get the knuckleheads elected to city and county and state jobs that made this toxic situation to begin with. So to some extent, I might say to the union members, your unions decided to get people like Kate Brown and Ted Wheeler and the rest of that bunch elected, and now you're suffering the consequences. Whose shoulder do you want to cry on? You helped create this toxic mess, and now your own workers are suffering. I hope your workers hold the unions responsible and tell them we might just get rid of you. You've done us no favors. You can read that story at WWeek.com. Aaron Mesh is the news editor at Willamette Week. Coming up in just a moment, how about guarding the garbage that's owned by some of those street people? We'll get to that in your calls coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, where we endeavor on a daily basis to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. I want to invite you to the conversation. And of course, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll. I was alerted to this by somebody in law enforcement because, you know, cops get a regular set of updates where they're told about changes in the law. And the Oregon legislature passed a bill called 587. And it had some obvious purposes to it, but buried deep, deep, deep within the law, it revokes one of what's called the Oregon Revised Statutes. I think it's RSWs in Washington, ORSs in Oregon. And that ORS in Oregon is one that says it is illegal, if you're under the age of 18, to possess tobacco products or vaping products. Okay, and everybody says, well, duh, Lars, we know that. But so what? All you would get if the police caught you with tobacco or vaping products if you're under 18, and if they choose to write you up, is called a Class D violation. A violation is a ticket. You know, so it'd come with potentially a fine. You might have to stand in front of a judge or whatever. And I don't imagine they probably wrote that many of them. But what was bizarre and what I was alerted to by a law enforcement friend is that the Oregon legislature has revoked the prohibition on minors possessing tobacco or vapes. And you wonder, well, hold on. We don't want to see the police spending a lot of time on that kind of thing. But if you've spent all these literally decades trying to say we have to get kids not to smoke cigarettes, and actually there's been some success to that. It's not overwhelming success, but a much smaller percentage of teenagers are smoking cigarettes than ever before. And that was supposed to be the goal. Not that I think that's government's job, but the government does define when you can drink, when you can smoke, when you can drive a car, things like that. But why in the world would they revoke this statute that's on the books so that if a police officer runs into a couple of 16-year-olds who are smoking cigarettes, he can say, look, it's illegal. I could write you a ticket, or you could just destroy the cigarettes, or let me take them and we'll throw them away, and problem solved. In other words, not something that you're going to have the cops spend a huge amount of time on. Why would 587, why would the Oregon legislature think it made sense or would do the kids any good to legalize the possession? They still are legally barred from buying cigarettes or buying vapes, but if they get their hands on cigarettes, it's no longer illegal for them to possess the cigarettes or the vapes. That one never made sense to me. So I'm going to ask the question, did Oregon lawmakers do kids, and by kids, I mean those under 18, any good by legalizing possession of cigarettes and vapes? I would say no to that. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Second thing, you know, for a long time, the roof of the Space Needle, And I love the Space Needle. I was taken there by my parents as a small child during the World's Fair, you know, when the Space Needle was first opened. And I've always been amazed by it because, you know, it's owned by private ownership. It's not owned and run by the government, thank God, because it's run very, very well by a private family that owns the Space Needle. And they said, we need to, for the 60th anniversary, we need to bring the roof of the Space Needle back to its original color. Now, officially, the original color was known as galaxy gold because it was, you know, we were in the middle of the space age at that point in 1962 at the World's Fair. So they called it galaxy gold. Now, I want to tell you something. That ain't gold. It is orange. So there have been a couple of comments that suggest that the Space Needle now with this orange cap on top of it looks a whole lot like a hypodermic with a needle attached to it, which I guess you could say is Seattle's way of recognizing all the heroin addicts and the other kind of illegal drug addicts that now populate Oregon and Washington. So they're honoring the drug addicts by having a giant hypodermic needle right there in downtown Seattle. The other thing that occurs to me, though, is that maybe secretly that they've had 15 months of Joe Biden. They've had the baby formula shortage. They've had the massive inflation. They've had the energy price increases. They've had just about every kind of calamity that any American president through incompetence or dementia or whatever it is that's causing it could bring upon a country. And maybe secretly Seattle is pining for the days of the man with orange hair. You know, I know they don't want to say his name out loud, so maybe we shouldn't bother them by doing that. But Orange Man, you know, the evil Orange Man, they now have a monument that's more than 500 feet tall sitting right there in the middle of downtown Seattle. And the top of it is painted the color that most of the left associates with the president who made America great. And maybe secretly they wish, couldn't we get back to those times, you know, full employment, businesses prospering, no wars, ending wars overseas instead of starting wars and getting into toe-to-toe, head-to-head confrontations with other nuclear-armed powers like Russia. Don't you wish we were back in those days? I think even liberals may secretly wish that we were back in the days of the Orange Man, and they secretly say, you know, a few mean tweets, what's the big deal if you can have good times instead of the Beijing Joe Biden times that we're in right now. It's Wednesday. It's the Lars Larson Show, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, the Radio Northwest Network that serves the Pacific Northwest and what we like to call honestly provocative talk radio. Now, earlier this week, I talked to one of the Republican candidates running for Oregon governor. I put out invitations to both of the Democrats. They have deferred and said they will not come on. And, of course, I've talked to the independent candidate, Betsy Johnson. But the question I put to Bob Tiernan earlier this week, I thought was a simple one. Was Joe Biden legitimately elected in 2020, in the November 3rd election? And the answer that I've given all of you consistently is no, he was not. And then last weekend, there was the brand new documentary called 2000 Mules that documents hard evidence that there were thousands of people who illegally stuffed ballot boxes in many, if not all, of the battleground states. And I thought, Bob can certainly give me an answer to this. And he said in a debate that no, that yes, Joe Biden was legitimately elected. So I thought, now I got an email today from a gentleman who said, boy, Bob sure won that argument. And I said, well, you're welcome to your interpretation, but I didn't get that impression. In fact, I threw down a bet to Bob and said, if you watch 2,000 Mules, come back on and tell me again that you believe the election of Joe Biden was legitimate. And we're going to wait for Bob's answer. He hasn't done it yet, but hey, the vote is less than a week away. Bridget Barton is the person that I'm actually endorsed, so I have a dog in the fight. Don't take that personally, Bridget. But welcome back to the program. I thought I'd put the same question to you. Was Joe Biden legitimately elected on November 3rd, 2020?
Well, first of all, I'm excited to be on to talk about this. But before I give you an answer, I'm out here in Gresham with the Mount Hood Republican Women, and they have to tell you what huge Lars Larson fans they are. So
That's very wonderful to hear. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I have seen 2,000 Mules, and, you know, that starts with about, what do they have, five really well-known conservative activists on that start the show with Dinesh D'Souza, and they all kind of give the answer that I was giving, which is, I don't know, I need hard evidence, I don't know, and what the sad thing is, that 2 years later, we don't know. Well, guess what? I've watched 2,000 Mules, and you cannot watch that documentary without concluding that there was a concerted effort and a no doubt successful effort to undermine that election by stuffing ballots. And it is appalling. It's absolutely appalling to see. And it kind of makes your stomach churn while you're watching it, realizing what happened. And I think one of the telling statements they say at the end is that while the Republicans were out spending their money campaigning with the people, trying to convince voters to go with them, the Democrats were out spending their money getting this accomplished behind the scenes. And that is a no doubt a sad reality.
And by the way, Bridget, I think it's worse than behind the scenes. There are lots of things that happen behind the scenes. I mean, there's advertising, there are things like that, but those are all legal. Stuffing ballot boxes and harvesting ballots is illegal. So yeah. I want to ask
Absolutely.
You for a definitive answer.
You don't do it in the dark of night.
No, you don't. But was Joe Biden legitimately elected on November 3rd?
After watching 2,000 Mules, I'd have to conclude no. No. This election, there was all this illegal stuff going on, stuffing of ballots, and it concerns me here in Oregon for this reason. I've been answering a lot of times in the campaign trail. We have two problems, and they both are problems. How the votes are counted once they're in, and whether the votes that are coming in the door are legitimate ballots. Now, so that's what this documentary really focuses on. And I watched as our legislature in this last session pushed through at the last minute a bill to make it nearly impossible to clean up the voter rolls. Nearly impossible. And when I saw that happening, I thought to myself, I know where the cheating is probably going on. It's on how the ballots are being stuffed and coming in the door. And I want to say, and I'll say it on the air, one of my opponents, Christine Drazen, voted for that bill. Makes it nearly impossible for us to track and see whether this is happening in our state. We have to get to the bottom of this, and I will.
Let me tell you something. Two concerns. We've already seen one of the major counties, one of the most populous counties, Clackamas County, has said, oh, we goofed on the ballots, so we'll have to actually sit down by hand and copy the votes over. If you don't, and apparently with not a lot of oversight to it, that makes me very suspicious. It opens up opportunities for fraud. The second thing, Bridget, because I've been asking for it on the air, a lot of people began sending me notes and pictures saying, look, I got two ballots this time. Or and one man even said, I got three ballots this time. And I said, send me a picture of those ballots so I can be sure they are this year's ballots. You know, not that I don't trust them, but I'm like Reagan, trust but verify. And they've been sending me pictures.
View.
Now, here's the problem, Bridget. You have everybody in the state who's of age gets automatically registered, which means you have literally hundreds of thousands of ballots floating around to people who probably don't plan to vote. Now, what happens to those ballots? A reasonable person would say you'd tear them in half or in quarters and throw them in the trash and make sure nobody else uses them if you're not going to. The problem is 2,000 Mules suggests that in Oregon, you could easily say, you're not going to vote your ballot? Give it to me. I'll take care of it. And that kind of thing, no audit would ever detect that, nor would an audit. I mean, Bridget, I've given the example. I live in Washington State. I could say, you know, I have an address at an office in Oregon. I could register to vote. Now, it's illegal for me to do that, so I'm not going to do it. But if I did it, and then I voted as L.K. Larson, how would an audit ever identify that I wasn't an Oregon voter?
Right. There's a million ways this can happen, Lars. You know that. I mean, people move all the time. People who live in apartments say they get multiple ballots from people who don't live there anymore. If you were not, you know, just an up and, you know, honest citizen, you could easily pass that vote, that ballot along to someone to go stuff in a ballot a drop box in the middle of the night. There is so much opportunity on the voter rolls because they've been so widely expanded. And at the same time, the legislation has come through to make it impossible to keep them cleaned up.
So, and by the way, let me throw one more thing in. Bridget for Oregon is your website. But you and
Bridget Barton for Oregon.
Bridget Barton for Oregon. 2 years ago, you and Jim Passero wrote a piece that was published in the Washington Examiner saying, if you're going to, because remember, we were in the early days of the pandemic then, and there were already states saying, well, then we have to go to vote by mail. And even though there were a number of states, including Wisconsin, that had poll votes with no trouble at all, right in the middle at the very beginning of the pandemic. And you wrote a piece saying, don't do it the way Oregon does it, because the unions have the horsepower, and it's the unions only. There is no conservative organization that could do this, have the horsepower to go out and do the kind of cheating, because they will check, and you pointed this out. People will say, they'll knock on your door and say, have you voted yet? They already know you haven't voted because they're tracking that day to day, and they're doing that to harvest from certain precincts where they know they're more likely to get Democrat votes. That's Bridget Barton. She is my choice for next week's primary on Tuesday in Oregon to choose the Republican nominee. The two Democratic candidates running for the Democrat nomination, they have both declined so far to come on this show, but they're invited. And we know we'll have Betsy Johnson on again, the independent candidate. But the Democrats, they're scared to answer serious questions. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails shortly, but there's something I've got to unload on, and it has to do with our freedoms. Because there are a couple of different developments over the last couple of years that I find very disturbing. Number one is the fact that over the last 2 years, we found out about how far government would go to try to take your freedoms away from you, to tell you, you must wear a mask on your face, you must take a jab in your arm, or maybe two or three or four, or God knows how many of them. For all I know, we're going to have frequent jab cards that people are going to have to fill out in the years ahead as they say, oh no, you're going to need three or four of these every year, because the so-called vaccine that truly is not a vaccine because it does not stop you from getting COVID is not something that lasts for very long. So that's point one. Point two, though, there is developing in American society an attitude that says, I want to be able to do dangerous things by choice. And by dangerous things, I mean, I used to snow ski. I haven't snow skied in a couple of years. But they tell you right there on the lift ticket, you're agreeing to take part in something that you know is inherently dangerous. I mean, even if you're a person who says, I try to ski very, very safely. I ski in control. I wear a helmet, all the rest of that stuff. And I do. I would do all those things. You're still doing something that by its very nature is dangerous and can even hurt you seriously or kill you. Now, there are lots of those kinds of activities. Rock climbing, skiing, skydiving. I mean, all of those things. So, with that in mind, I want to tell you about a lawsuit, a case. It's a legal settlement case in which a jury awarded more than $11 million to a guy by the name of Gabriel Owens. Now, what do we know about Gabriel Owens? Gabriel Owens was apparently a top flight mountain bike rider. Now, I have a mountain bike, but I don't go out on the kind of trails this guy goes out on. But that's his choice. It's his choice to decide to go, as he did, about 6 years ago, to a place called Mount Hood Ski Bowl. Now, in the wintertime, it's a place to go skiing. You know, and in fact, I took my little granddaughter up there this last winter because we let her go tubing. You know, she's 6 years old and she's just a joy. And it's a fun place to be. And the place has developed a summertime audience of people who like to do other things like mountain bike. Well, they have now decided that this summer there's not going to be any mountain biking because a jury has decided to award $11 million to Gabriel Owens. He got hurt. Now, let me describe the circumstances under which Gabriel Owens ended up paralyzed, which is a horrible thing to happen to any person. But if you're a person who decides to take part in a dangerous activity, and by its very nature, you're assuming some of the risk. But he says that his accident ended in his being paralyzed because of failures on the part of the people who maintained the trail that he was riding on. Now, when I go skiing, if you've ever been skiing before, you understand that all the runs are marked. A lot of times they're marked by a circle. Sometimes they're marked with a square. Circles are the easy runs, the bunny slopes. Squares, they're tougher. Diamonds are tougher still. Double diamonds, yeah, that's for the people who really know what they're doing. So here's Gabriel Owens in 2016, July of that year, and he's riding along what's known as the Double Black Diamond Cannonball Trail. Now, if you ever needed a name that would describe the potential hazards, it's the Double Black Diamond Cannonball Trail. And while he's riding down this trail, even his lawyers admit he lost control of his bike. Now, when I'm riding a bicycle, there are a lot of things that can happen that are not your fault. You know, a kid throws a ball out in front of you and your bike tire hits it. Maybe you go down to the pavement. That's not something you did. But if you're riding on the Double Black Diamond Cannonball Trail and your lawyers say he lost control of his bike, he crashed and he slid downhill. And as he slid down the hill, he slams into a 4x4-inch wooden signpost. Now, you can imagine what that would do to a person. The impact injured Owen's spinal cord, according to the reports and the trial. He was paralyzed from the waist down. Horrible thing to happen to somebody who's an active athlete. But his lawyers argued that those posts along the trail, specifically those within what they call a crash zone, where high-speed falls and high speeds are foreseeable, should have been designed to break away in the event of a collision. Probably a great idea. But when you've decided to ride the trail, and I've talked to people about this, I've said, listen, I know people who used to run cross country. I didn't run cross country, but they would oftentimes go out for an easy jog along the entire course because they wanted to see what the course looked like. When people are involved in automobile racing, in many cases, they'll either drive the course at a regular speed to kind of get a feel for what it's like. In some cases, race drivers even walk the course so they can see all the hazards. Now, I don't know if Gabriel Owens did that or not. After the verdict from the jury, Skibol is planning to appeal, and then they had a settlement at $10.5 million. But they said the future of mountain biking trails there remains uncertain, and it's because of the legal landscape. Because apparently what Americans want to do is they want to have their cake and eat it too. They say, we want to go out and do these dangerous things. And with the reason I brought up COVID at the beginning, if you've decided you don't want to get the jab, I'm behind you. If you've decided you want to take the jab, I think you should have that option as well. And I think it should be your decision. And I think when you make that decision, you should take the consequences that come with it. If I decide at the ripe old age of 63 to go back up and start doing some snow skiing, believe me, I'm a boring snow skier. I'm not the mogul kind of guy or gal, you know. And so if I'm sliding down the hill, I'm always prepared to fall down and stop if I have to. And I do wear a helmet and I take all the precautions. But I understand that when I take on that kind of dangerous activity for myself, that that's my choice. I want that freedom. But freedom and responsibility have to be two sides of the same coin. If you say, I want freedom, but I don't want to have to take responsibility for the choices that I make, that doesn't work. On the other hand, if you're held responsible for what you do, but you have no control over what you do, like when your boss or the government says you have to take the jab, you have to do this, you may not do that, well, then you don't have any responsibility either. In this case, I think this man had an accident, and it's terrible that he ended up paralyzed as he did. I hope that medical science figures out how to fix him someday. But for him to say, I want to do inherently dangerous things, and if something goes wrong, I want to blame somebody else. I want to say that wasn't my fault that I was going at high speed when I lost control and crashed and slid. I want to say, no, it was Skibo's fault that I ran into a post. They should have assumed that I was going to crash, slide down a hill, and run into a 4x4 post. The signs have to be there, and the responsibility has to be there as well. At least that's my take on it. I feel for this guy, but I don't think he deserves a $10 million check. And I don't think the rest of us deserve to get the consequences when people then say, well, then we're not going to offer those opportunities or those choices anymore. They were taken away by Gabriel Owens. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If I have a dog in the fight on this following conversation, it has to do with I have to fill up my family's vehicles as well. And the fill-up price is north of $5 a gallon because, well, the owner's manual on our cars say we're supposed to use premium-grade gas, although I may have to reconsider that going into the future. But I wanted to talk to Steve Malloy about it, who's a former member of Donald Trump's EPA transition team and the founder of JunkScience.com. Steve, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So all of us have noticed the cost of diesel and gasoline have gone up dramatically. And in fact, they've even gone up since the president raided the emergency stockpile of oil and began shipping some of it overseas. We can bring that in if you like. But I've seen Joe Biden as recently as this morning, the president of the United States, saying this isn't his increase. It's not driven by his policies. No, it's driven by Vladimir Putin. Should we buy that?
No, Joe Biden is blaming everybody but himself. He's the only one that is responsible for all this. Sure, Putin helped a little bit, but this is really all a Joe Biden thing. Since Joe Biden became president, and indeed he even campaigned on this, he has been discouraging the oil and gas industry from producing. You know, under President Trump, we were producing record amounts of oil and gas, so much that, you know, at the beginning of COVID, we forced Russia and Saudi Arabia into an oil production war, and the price of oil actually went negative for a while. So we were producing quite a bit. Then Joe Biden becomes president, and all of a sudden, the oil and gas industry is scared of producing. I mean, he's been discouraging them. You know, he shut down Keystone XL pipeline. He stopped issuing leases for new drilling on federal lands. He's let loose the regulatory state. We can't build pipelines now. He's got the EPA teed up to go after fossil fuel emissions. So the whole industry is scared and not producing as much as they could. And Joe Biden is, you know, although he says, yeah, I'm doing everything I can to lower gas prices, in fact, he's doing nothing. He's actually making it more difficult.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I think that Joe Biden is doing what the kids like to call gaslighting, because as recently as yesterday, he was saying, well, you know, these oil companies, and he paints them as the bad guys, which I think, sadly, it's relatively easy to do. Even though I don't think the oil companies are the bad guys. I think they're relatively easy to understand. What a private company is supposed to do for its owners, or in this case, in many cases, stockholders, which include average Americans and union members and everybody else, is make as much money as they legally can do. Now, some companies, you and I have talked about this environmentally sensitive, investing crap. If you want to do that by your choice, go ahead. Say, I'm going to avoid all the high return stocks and I'm going to buy the low return stock. God bless you. It'll leave more of the other for us. But Biden makes this point that he says, well, you know, having shut down new leasing on federal lands and then opened it back up to, I think, 20% of the former number, he then says, well, these oil companies, they're just sitting on these 9,000 leases. Would you mind deconstructing that a little bit? Because if I were a small oil company, and many of the companies that do the actual drilling, they're mom and pop operations. Yeah. They're really tiny companies. They're not Exxon or Mobil or any of the other majors that you know the names of because you buy their gas. These are mom and pops that go out. They borrow money from investors and they drill holes in the ground at $5 to $10 million each. But having the lease does not mean you can actually drill for oil, does it?
Yeah, so it's true there are about 9,000 leases out there that are being unused. But you know, the part of the story the Joe Biden doesn't tell is that lease utilization is at a historic high. It's like 75%. So there are also 27,000 other leases that are being used. Of the 9,000 leases that aren't being used, just because you have a lease doesn't mean you have a claim worth drilling. I think half of those leases have actual permits. And just because, once again, just because you have a permit doesn't mean that there's anything there. They've got the wells have to be economic to drill. Many of the leases, several thousand, are in litigation. So the notion that oil companies are sitting on leases is simply false. If there was a way for them to make money now with $100 a barrel of oil, they would be doing it. You know, it costs them maybe like $30 to get oil out of the ground. Of course, they would be taking advantage of it if they could. And if investors were confident that, these investments, which cost billions of dollars and take a long time to plan and prepare, you know, if they were going to come to fruition, not be blocked by environmental groups. So that, you know, that's just completely, you know, Joe Biden just making stuff up. He wants high gas prices. His administration has said this, or says this every time they can. You know, what they want to do is advance their climate agenda. They think that high gas prices are going to force people into EVs. That's the whole game here.
Except that the EVs aren't there to sell. They sold 500,000 of them last year, which is a lot of cars, but it's a fraction of the 16 to 18 million cars that are sold every single year, the rest of them gas and diesel. So the other gaslighting that I think they've been involved in is Biden wants to buy into, and I would say this, Biden, for all his criticism of conspiracy theory and MAGA and everything else, one of the big conspiracy theories is all the big oil companies get together and they have lunch and they say, how much should we charge for gas?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that they violate the antitrust laws and they conspire. Well, as you pointed out, when oil was cheap, that would have been the time and it would have been very attractive to say, let's sit together and we'll form a cartel like OPEC, which is illegal in America, and we'll engineer the prices higher. If I understand the numbers right, Stephen, I think you have them better than I do. When you buy a gallon of gas, after you take the taxes off, which are 50 or 60 cents a gallon, the remaining cost, 75% of that represents the oil that had to go into that oil or gas. The other 25%, as I understand the numbers, goes for refining, shipping, insurance, some little bit of profit, et cetera, et cetera. But that's how the numbers break out. So when the oil goes from $52 when Joe became president to, I think, 110 now, and it did go as high as, I think, 125 or 150 a barrel, that the 75% is the cost of that barrel of oil that goes into the gas. Are the numbers about right? Do I have them about right?
That's absolutely right, Lars. And you know, look, oil companies have been accused of gouging ever since the 1970s. There have been, you know, umpteen investigations into this by the government and others, and no one has ever been able to find anything. The oil companies are not gouging us. Yes, they're making more money now because, well, they're clever businessmen, and as prices go up, you know, they can make money. And so what? No, as you pointed out, no one was complaining when gas was $2, right? I remember buying gas for less than $2. So, yeah, they are making money, but so what? Most of the increase is because of the price of oil. And when oil goes up, gasoline goes up. It's not gouging. You know, Biden has, he claims, you know, he's been releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He's been telling people this is going to lower prices. Oil prices are still over $100 a barrel. He's doing nothing, and he's doing nothing on purpose.
Well, and don't the numbers suggest, I mean, I looked up because I used to say the world uses 80 million barrels a day. It's actually 97 million. It's almost 100 million barrels a day.
Yeah.
So when you say we're using 100 million barrels a day, and Joe says, I'm going to drop 1 million barrels in, you say, you know, we're going to bail out the ocean with a bucket? I mean, 1 million added to 100 million is going to change the price by how much? Nothing much at all, right?
Right. No, and then, you know, Joe Biden is asking OPEC and Venezuela and Iran, Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Of course, they've all turned him down. Why wouldn't you ask American producers? You would create jobs. You would create wealth. You would lower
You'd create
gas
a firestorm you among your tree-hugging friends, though.
Yeah,
wouldn't you?
But you would lower inflation, right? I mean, you know, Democrats are going to get blown out in the fall because people are going to be tired of, you know, inflation and paying $5, $6, $7 for gasoline.
That's right. That's Steve Milloy, the founder of Junk Science. He served as a member of Donald Trump's EPA transition team, and I wish we had people like Steve Milloy back in the government. Instead, we've got old befuddled Joe, who doesn't seem to know what he's doing, but he gaslights with the best of them. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I'll be back to your calls in just a moment. I want to go to a naysayer. Because we like to have naysayers on this show. I established that tradition about 25 years ago. We're about to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the show. And my producers thought I was a producer. I only had one at the time. Thought I was crazy to put people whose point of view was different than mine up front. But I like doing it. Jason, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
It's profiteering, Lars. It's clearly profiteering.
What is profiteering? You said it is. That's an antecedent. What are you referring to?
Well, the 8% that everyone's talking about, the gouging, the definition of gouging in the dictionary.
Well, you said it's profiteering. What do you consider to be gouging? What do you consider to be gouging?
The gouging the economy. I'm a little nervous. I'm sorry.
Well, don't be nervous. I just want to know what you say. What do you mean by gouge? Gouge means overcharge, right? Jason, gouge means to overcharge. I get that. So, if you're in the kind of business where oil is sold around the world, it's traded on commodities markets, and when people decide to buy oil or sell oil, they buy at the market price. Or probably just a little bit over the market price. So if somebody says, I'll offer you oil at $110 a barrel, and you say,
then
okay.
Make it down with 8% ethanol.
Well, but that's by the government's order. We don't have any choice about that other than to elect different people to Congress, which I think is going to happen big time this fall. But when you have the government say, mix in ethanol, that's not something you have a choice about doing. If the government decrees it, then it happens. So if the gouging is happening, it's happening on behalf of Congress, who are your representatives, correct?
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
But ethanol your only argument, or do you actually think that the oil companies are charging more for the oil or more for the gasoline than the marketplace would suggest?
Well, it seems like it's not going. Price of oil isn't decreasing. There's 8 million people.
But it's all about supply. It's all about supply and demand. So, Jason, if you were in the oil business, and somebody said to you, Jason, how much would you like to make per barrel? You'd probably say, I'd like to make $400 a barrel. And if you went out and said, I'm going to gouge, I'm going to sell my oil for $400 a barrel.
Hold on, Jason, listen.
There is not an endless supply of oil that is available right now. Now, if you say, is there an endless supply of oil? I believe you're actually right. When Jimmy Carter was president, which is back in the 70s, he said we would be out of oil by the 90s. We now have more proven reserves in hand today, you know, proven wells that are full of oil than we knew about in the 1970s. Jimmy Carter was wrong all day long and twice on Sunday. But let's go back to my question to you. Say you go out and say, I don't want to make $110 a barrel, which I think is the current price. I want to make $140 a barrel. If you offer your oil up for $140 a barrel, how many buyers are you going to get?
Probably not as many.
Not as many? Is anybody going to buy your oil at $140 a barrel when the market price is $110?
Well, it's a necessity. It's a commodity. People have.
Didn't ask you that. A steak is a necessity. If you go to the store, I don't know what steak is going for now, but I would guess it's $10 a pound. But if somebody says, "Well, I'm going to charge $30 a pound for steak," they're not going to get a single buyer, are they?
Well, they have you over the barrel. You see, people have to have gasoline at any price.
Yes, but when you have, do you think the different oil companies compete? So if you're a company that has developed wells and you say, we have oil here, we want to sell it. How much do you want to sell it for? Well, what's the market price? $110. Well, we'll sell it for $109.75. You're going to have buyers lined up at your door. On the other hand, if you come in when the market is $110 and say, I want $112 for my barrel of oil, nobody is going to buy from you.
I wasn't just talking about oil. I'm talking about the price of everything, just to convenience stores.
Okay, but we can't. You started talking about oil. Everything else is controlled by the same market price. When a big supermarket chain goes out to a company that owns laying hens and says, we want to buy eggs, and they say, we want, $3 a carton, $3 a dozen. And you say, well, I can buy them for $2.75 a dozen from your competitor down the street. Nobody's going to pay $3 if the competitor will sell for $2.75. That's how a marketplace works, Jason.
This number 8 keeps popping up. This 8% inflation rate.
Well, no, 8% for inflation.
8% of the earth is populated by man.
What?
It's just the number
8% of the earth is not populated by man. Jason, do you know, here in the Pacific Northwest, do you know how much land human beings occupy in Oregon and Washington as a percentage of all the land?
Less than 8%?
2.5%. 2.5%. In other words, 97.5% of the land in Oregon and Washington is empty. It doesn't have roads or schools or businesses or people or houses on it. It is empty. Right?
Lars is the all-knowing.
No, I'm not the all-knowing, but you know what, Jason? If you mean that seriously, all I'm saying is helps to look up the numbers. Just like when I used to say I thought the world used about 80 million barrels a day. I looked up the more current number. It's 97 million barrels of oil that the world runs on right now. So when Joe Biden throws an extra 1 million barrels in and adds less than 1%, it ain't going to make much difference, but Joe thinks it looks good for election times. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. We serve Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And we're glad to take your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line always at 866-439-5277. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. Go to NickShivers.com for details. Now, I want you to join me in welcoming Washington State Senator Phil Fortunato, a Republican from District 31. Senator, glad to have you back on the show.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
I want to bring people up to date that in the last hour or so, the United States Senate, and I'm going to say it in a way that I almost guarantee no TV news operation in Seattle or Portland or any of the other Northwest cities will say it this way. A majority of United States senators have voted no on the idea of legalizing abortion through statute but passed by the Congress. Now, this was a vote in the U.S. Senate. A majority of senators voted no. A minority of senators, all of them Democrats, voted yes. And that whole idea is dead and gone. Now, King County has taken an action that I wanted to ask you about. In anticipation of both the failure of the Congress and of the decision that we think is coming from the U.S. Supreme Court to say that Roe v. Wade was a terrible decision, it was bad law, badly decided, and it's going to be overturned, as the Supreme Court has also overturned a number of other mistakes that it has made throughout its history. And they were some doozies over the years, and I think Roe v. Wade is one of them. What did King County's council do in anticipation of this?
So they passed a resolution saying that basically what the Supreme Court decides doesn't apply in King County. King County is not going to abide by a Supreme Court ruling. Now, this communicates to people in King County that they have no idea how the Constitution actually works. You know, in the 60s, you had some rulings to desegregation. And the Democrats then opposed that. Southern Democrats opposed the ruling on segregation. Now, that was a national ruling on the 14th Amendment.
Right.
This, however, is different because this is actually a 10th Amendment issue. because if the Supreme Court does overturn Roe v. Wade, you know what that means to people in Washington? Zero. Absolutely no change. Why? Because now the Supreme Court says those decisions get determined by the state. So it now becomes a state issue. So by the King County passing this resolution, they're basically trying to incite the pro-abortion people and get them all worked up that somehow things are going to change in Washington state. That's not the case. And these people, I just want you to understand what happened in the legislative session. The Democrats are so enamored with abortion. They want to protect it so much that what they've done is they have passed a bill that says you no longer have to be a doctor to terminate a pregnancy. A healthcare professional can do it. And if that healthcare professional screws up, you don't have any recourse. So they're exempt from any liability. So that means every member of the King County Council can self-identify as a healthcare professional and go out there and do abortions. And if they screw up and somebody dies or somebody's sterile God forbid, a baby survives this abortion attempt, they would be immune from prosecution. That's what this state passed in this last legislative session. So they are protecting the right of a woman to basically have anybody do an abortion. Remember, they want to have abortion should be legal and safe. Well, it may be legal, but it's sure as hell isn't safe. And if they screw up, there's no recourse. A woman does not have any recourse if she winds up being sterile from this procedure. That's what the Democrats have passed. And that is what King County Council is fighting for.
This is insane because, Senator, we all know that there are screw-ups in abortions. I mean, I'm pro-life, so I don't agree with the idea of abortion. But there are abortions where the baby comes out alive. And at that point, legally, you have a different situation. You have a living baby, and I think the medical community owes it to that living baby to do everything to preserve that baby's life. And we also know, Phil, because I've looked at this over the years, one of the debates that involved State Senator Barack Obama in Illinois back in the day was whether or not to pass a law saying if the baby is born alive, even though you intended to abort it, you have to do everything you can to preserve that life. And Barack Hussein Obama famously or infamously voted to say, no, I don't want that to be the law. And what as ugly as it sounds, there are doctors who perform what they think is an abortion. They do not kill the baby. The baby comes out alive. And you know what they routinely do, Senator? They set the baby in a bassinet in another room. You know, so they can't actively kill it. They can't shoot it full of drugs. They can't strangle it. They can't do what Kermit Gosnell, the abortion murderer in Philadelphia, did. But they set it in a bassinet in another room and say, ignore it for a few hours and it will die. And that is literally how ugly this gets, that they would say, well, if the baby happens to survive accidentally, just put it somewhere, you know, like some evil person would take a dog or cat and just dump them by the side of the road.
Right. Well, recently I've been getting inundated with the pro-choice people calling me up, asking my position on abortion. I happen to be pro-life. I'm not voting for anything that's going to inhibit the ability of a baby to live, but what these people are doing is ridiculous. I mean, we heard a passionate speech, for example, on a woman's right to know of the complications from breast implants. Passionate speeches on the other side. It was a Democrat-sponsored bill. And the legislature finds that all these horrible things happen if a woman has a breast implant, and she has the right to know. So I took that same bill, and I said, make it an abortion bill. If a woman has a right to know about what the complications are to a breast implant, why doesn't she have the right to know of the complications of abortion? I sponsored another bill. Very simple. Now, does that bill impede the woman's right to have an abortion? No, but it does give her informed information to make that decision. I passed another bill. years ago, you would be able to open up the Department of Health report on abortion, and you would be able to see so many abortions in Washington, so many women stayed in a hospital more than 3 days. The level of care for abortion is so low that you could stay in the hospital for 3 days, and that is considered normal. You could leave body parts in a woman, and that is considered normal.
Unbelievable. That is Senator Phil Fortunato, the Republican from District 31. Senator, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I'll get to your phone calls and emails coming up next and talk about the pervert sex offender coach that Seattle Public Schools kept on the payroll. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to get with you and to invite your calls. And I want to invite your Twitter poll votes as well, because this one was truly bizarre. It was brought to my attention by somebody in law enforcement who said, Lars, did you know that the Oregon lawmakers in Salem passed a bill called 587? And buried deep inside it, it revokes the Oregon revised statute that makes possession of tobacco and vapes by kids illegal. That was the law, but 587 revoked it. And for the life of me, I can't understand why lawmakers would think it was a great idea to make it legal for kids to possess tobacco or vapes. I mean, there's been such a drumbeat in favor of kids not smoking. I get it. I think it's sensible to say wait till you're old enough to be able to make a decision. And then if you decide to use tobacco, that's your decision as an adult, although you're sure to face a lot of opposition from people who are going to try to say, we don't care, it shouldn't be your choice. I don't think that's the case for adults. I do think that's the case for kids. And I would love to know, again, this was brought to my attention by somebody in law enforcement who said, why did they revoke the Oregon revised statute? That means effectively, you're not going to see massive police raids going after kids for cigarettes. But if an officer happens to encounter somebody who's underage and says, you're smoking, are you old enough? Are you 21? And the kid says no, he can say, well, I'm taking the cigarettes. I'm going to write you a ticket for minor in possession. Now, that would be the worst case. The best case scenario might be an officer who says, you can't smoke. Give me the cigarettes. We'll destroy them. I'll step on a pack of cigarettes and wipe them out. You're not allowed to have these. The cop can no longer do that. Now, on that note, let's go to Rob Reynolds, who's running as a candidate in Oregon's 41st House District for the legislature. Rob, welcome to the program, and explain to my audience why you should be voted in as a representative of the people. Rob? Well, that's the first thing. The first clue is you have to show up for the job. So I guess Rob isn't there, but he missed his opportunity. Sorry about that. Let's go to David. Hey, David, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, Lars, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I just called in. Didn't know. It's one of those to let you know. Apparently there is a big push that's being on the fast track to put in a whole bunch of windmills off the Southern Oregon coast here.
That's true. And in fact, they've been building windmills like crazy in California. They've been doing it in Washington State. There are plans for both the South Oregon coast and the North Oregon coast as well. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, according to their maps for the fisheries that we have going off the coast here from Brookings, that will cover basically Coos Bay to Newport, it's going to shut down 40+% of the fishing grounds of all of our fisheries to where the commercial fleets actually catch fish.
Now, shut them down permanently or shut them down during construction?
Shut them down permanently. They're going to build a safety zone around them.
Okay, but how? I guess I'm curious to know the details. Is the safety zone going to be, I mean, every windmill you have to stay a quarter mile away or a few hundred yards away? What kind of limits are they putting on that?
If you look at the dotted line on the maps that they're producing, I was just shown one. I was hoping you'd have more access to it. If you look at the actual areas that they're covering this is like make a marine fishery look little.
And because they're walling off these entire areas? I mean, it's one thing, I suppose, to say you've got to stay away from this area. I mean, there are areas of Puget Sound that you have to stay away from because they do submarine testing. You know, there are lots of different areas that are restricted for one reason or another. But why would there be a need to restrict, unless they're assuming that if boats are anchoring offshore and they've got connections between those windmills and the shore, of course, to carry the electricity ashore, I'm wondering how people are going to react to the idea that you gain a power resource at the expense of a fishery.
Well, why then is that the company that's doing it put out that they're going to produce enough electricity for 2 million households, but apparently not 1 kilowatt goes to the state of Oregon. It's all going to California.
And should that surprise any of us? And frankly, David, I don't want to be called a hypocrite because you know that there are 12 different coal, well, there were 12 different coal-fired power plants outside of Oregon and Washington that supply the region. So it's not unusual to have power made in one place and then shipped somewhere else. You know, just like I'm sure that there are places where, you know, the milk you drink at your local or the eggs you have at your local grocery store may be coming from another region or another political jurisdiction. I mean, it may not be coming from your county or even your state. In fact, in Southern Oregon, you may be getting a lot of your milk and dairy and everything else from California, from farms in California, or you may be getting them from Oregon. I don't know. That's not necessarily a deal killer for me if you say, well, gee, this power is made here and it's actually being used there. That's not necessarily a deal killer. But if it costs Oregon its fishery and it's to generate power for California, I think it's certainly worth asking, should we allow it?
Well, then another aspect of it, because it's been proven, because, you know, the salmon fishing here on the Coke Hill just got shut down. We can't even catch a salmon. But they've proven with the studies that even with salmon, they operate off an electromagnetic field that's built in. They have a built-in GPS.
They
and
do.
If they start changing the electrical wavelengths out there in the ocean.
Would the windmills do that? Because I'm asking the question, in other words, would one windmill or a group of windmills and the wires necessary to connect, the cables necessary to connect them to shore, would they actually change things? I think it's a question worth asking. David, thanks for the call. John is a naysayer, except he sounds like a dog right now. John, are you there?
I am here.
Is that your dog in the fight?
No, that's actually some customer's dog in the Amazon delivery.
Okay. Tell me this then. What do you and I disagree about today if you're a naysayer?
So I disagree that the law shouldn't have been removed on the MIPs because I believe it should have been revamped. Not completely done away with, but revamped, because if a minor gets a DUI after he's had an MIP, he gets no diversion. My stepson.
Does that apply to smoking
DUI,
as well? Does that apply to smoking?
Yes, yes. My stepson got a DUI when he was 21 and a half years old, went out, had about 3 beers, and got a DUI, faced his consequences, but it wasn't counted as his first DUI, is in that he could go to diversion classes. He had to go to... he got convicted of his second DUI because he had an MIP for having a can of chew when he was in high school.
And a can of chew meant that it kept him from going to diversion on an alcohol DUI?
Yep, because he had an MIP that was already having gone to diversion.
And it was for having chewing tobacco.
That, yep.
I would agree with you, because I'm not, like I said, I'm not looking for the cops to go out and raid the kids or start doing major raids to find packs of cigarettes. On the other hand, if they can say, I'll write you a ticket, that fits in with the philosophy that you don't want kids smoking. And if you make it legal for them to possess it, that kind of undercuts the message. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Of course, we're in an election year, although based on the behavior of the Democrats lately, you wouldn't know it because they seem to be doing everything they can to make sure that voters don't want to vote for Democrat candidates. But having said that, I want to talk about the Election Transparency Initiative And the man behind it is Ken Cuccinelli, the national chair of the Election Transparency Initiative, former attorney general of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and former acting deputy secretary at Homeland Security. How are you doing, Ken?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, although I'm frustrated that there's a great new documentary out. It has its flaws, but it's 2,000 Mules. I watched it last weekend. I know Dinesh D'Souza reasonably well, and he did a very good job, although I think he could have closed the loop on a few issues that were within the documentary. But having said that, I think there's every reason to be concerned that this year's elections may be gimmicked by the Democrats again. Where do we stand in terms of trying to make this thing more solid during this election year, or is it too late?
Oh, no, it's not too late. There's still, frankly, there's still some great bills out in some of the states that are moving forward. And I expect some of them are going to pass into law. The biggest single, literally vote moving, sketchy aspect of 2020 was Zuckerbucks. Single biggest element that moved votes in what I would call an inappropriate fashion.
how about illegal? Can we say illegal?
That was just it. I mean, was it? And what we have let the IRS has let what passes for nonpartisan go and in such a way that can be gamed by everybody who participates and has never, crack down on that in any way. And so this was, I think it was Steve Moore who said they legally stole the election. But it was dirty. I mean, we expect government to play a neutral role. And Zuckerbucks undid that in key areas as they intended. That was their target. But I will tell you for this year, because your question's about this year.
Yeah.
Over a third of the states have now either completely barred or severely restricted Zuckerbucks opportunities, and I expect more before the end of the year and before we get to elections will have done the same, including in some key areas. That's point one. Point two, it's a whole lot harder to make Zuckerbucks actually impactful for the midterms than it was in a presidential. You'll remember the Republicans gained about a dozen seats in the House of Representatives. Well, how could that be? Because let's just take Philadelphia, where a lot of Zuckerbucks went. They drove up turnout in a 90-10 Democrat area, but they already had Democrat congressmen. So the same tactic doesn't help them in the swing districts for Congress that are spread all over the country in the same way that it did in the presidential, where their effect was very, very concentrated. And that doesn't mean we don't have other problems like these drop boxes. You were talking about the Mules movie and the failure of security associated with those. But frankly, a lot of these tactics now have a level of oversight from the right they have never had before. We've never had so many litigators fighting over these things on our behalf. The other side was always in court for almost two decades now, and we weren't there. Well, we're there now. We've got watchdogs. And I'll tell you about Virginia, where I live, as you know. I was the AG here a few years back. In the 2021 election, biggest election in the country last year, thousands of Virginians, and everybody listening to you and me can do this, thousands of Virginians stepped forward and got trained as election officials, not campaign workers, not poll watchers. They ran the elections. People who are concerned about elections went inside and did it themselves and made sure everybody played by the rules, were honest and straight and transparent. And in Virginia, in the areas of the state we have the most concern about fraud, frankly, over 90% of the slots available to Republicans in Virginia, it's done by party, and that's true in most states, available to Republicans were filled in those suspicious jurisdictions or the ones we're the most concerned about. And we did have problems in those jurisdictions. And you know who spotted them? These new volunteers who came in and got trained, and they got extra training from outside groups that came together to do that. It works. And so, you know, folks listening who are concerned about this, know you can do something about it. You can do it where you live. And thousands of people, 3,000 to 4,000 in Virginia, did exactly that last year, and it worked. The Democrats took control of our legislature and governorship in 2019. They made over 60 changes to our election laws, including making it election season 45 days long. And yet we covered all the spaces, or almost all the spaces we needed to make sure everybody played by the rules. And then when whatever your state's rules are, you can't really complain about that. You've got to win with the rules on the books. The problem we had in 2020 is they weren't obeying the rules.
No, they weren't. And in fact, I mean, my biggest beef about the election in 2020, one of the biggest beefs, was that states made changes to the rules, but the Constitution says there's one way to do that, through the legislature, in your case, the Assembly. Yeah. And they said, oh, no, our elections director changed the rules, or the governor changed the rules, or a judge changed the rules, or judges. And you say, hold on. The Constitution says any of those changes are absolutely out of line and should not have been allowed. And that never really got challenged, did it?
Well, it never got litigated. And, you know, people complained about it, but those cases were getting dismissed and they shouldn't have been. Last year, last March, so 14 months ago, Justice Thomas, in a dissent, where they rejected a consideration of an election case, and of course it was after the election was over, nonetheless, he said, look, we always reject these things after elections and say they're no longer moot. I mean, they are moot. They're no longer relevant. And before elections, we say they haven't ripened. So we never give adequate guidance. And I think the court, I think actually that dissent was a significantly impactful chastisement by Justice Thomas. I think going forward, you're going to see more guidance from the courts, and that means that these questions are going to be more thoroughly considered, and we're going to get back to the constitutional base that you described quite properly. And I would add one more to your list.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Of cheaters. You had state officials who didn't obey their own laws, not because it was changed by election officials or judges. We saw this in Georgia. We saw it in Pennsylvania, where they wouldn't let observers participate in the way the law allowed for it, Michigan. And you don't pass laws to say you have to obey the law. That's what the original law is for in the first place. And the legislature did lay out the terms, and the folks involved there didn't obey them. And state legislatures need to take control of that, and they need to discipline those folks. You saw Georgia do that. You go back 20 years after Bush v. Gore, you saw Florida do it. They were humiliated, but I would remind you, it took them years of legislating and firing all the right people to really improve their elections. And now they're one of the best-run large states out there.
Ken, I appreciate the time. That's Ken Cuccinelli, who's the national chair of the Election Transparency Initiative, the former AG of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and former acting deputy secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. Ken, we always appreciate your insights. If you'd like to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation around, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our Twitter poll. Today's question, did Oregon lawmakers do the kids, that is, those under 18, any good by legalizing possession of cigarettes and vapes? The change was buried in a bill called 587, and it simply got rid of the Oregon revised statute that makes possession of tobacco and vapes by kids illegal and subject to a ticket. It is a Class D violation, which means it's a relatively low-level ticket. But it at least said if a kid has cigarettes or vapes and is under the age of 18, then that's illegal. And they got rid of the law. And for the life of me, I can't wait to hear somebody explain to me why they thought that was a good idea. I did promise to tell you about this story a little bit earlier, so let me do it now. The Seattle Public Schools have agreed to pay $3 million to a student who says she was sexually abused by a former coach at Ballard High School. Now, when I see these kinds of things, I refer to a lot of them as the lawsuit lottery. I don't think that's the case here, because here's what we find out. The Seattle Times actually covered the story, and I'll give the fish wrapper credit for doing it. The lawsuit was filed about 2 years ago. Now, the student said she was sexually abused by a female soccer coach starting in 2016, about 6 years ago, when she was a 15-year-old sophomore at Ballard High School. The coach was also an instructional assistant at the school, where she was assigned to work with special needs kids. So she's working with some of the most vulnerable kids there are. The student says she was abused once a week from 2016 to 2018 when allegations of her abuse were uncovered. The lawsuit claimed the school district was liable for the abuse because it failed to protect her, get this, despite knowing that the coach posed a danger to her and the other students. Why? That coach was first hired by Seattle Public Schools in 2007 as an assistant girls soccer coach. Notice how perverts tend to gravitate toward opportunities to be in close contact with their potential victims. That's called grooming. Now, the attorneys found the coach hired in 2007 as an assistant girls soccer coach and basketball coach at Roosevelt High School. During her two-year tenure at Roosevelt, the coach demonstrated what her direct supervisor described as a, quote, pattern of predatory behavior and repeated boundary violations with students that ultimately led to her termination in 2009. Now, even though the coach had been previously terminated for exactly that kind of activity, Seattle Public Schools rehired her a year later to be what? To be the assistant girls soccer coach at Ballard High. Her responsibilities expanded a few years later in 2015 to include work as an instructional assistant where she worked with special ed kids. Now, I want you to think about this. You're running an operation involving the schools, and the schools serve, the fancy Latin term is in loco parentis. That is, you are there in place of the parent for a period of the day. You're calling the shots for that child. It's your job. It is your responsibility to take care of that child. You have a coach come on board, works in the schools for 2 years, demonstrates a pattern of predatory behavior and repeated boundary violations. That's either putting your hands places they don't belong or doing things with kids where you're crossing the line. You're there 2 years, you get fired, and the Seattle schools hire you right back? I mean, it used to be, And there was a great series that was done by the Seattle Daily Dead Fish Wrapper years ago where they talked about passing the trash. And I still remember this story because it was really quite a good series of stories where they described a process in which one school in one district would say, we've got a teacher here. The teacher is behaving in a way that is dangerous to the kids, you know, sexually dangerous, dangerous in whatever way. And they would sit down with the teacher, and the teacher's lawyer would say, you can't do anything to my client unless you can prove in court beyond a reasonable doubt that they've been doing these things. And if you say anything that affects their future as a teacher, we're going to sue you for defamation. And so what the schools did back then, this is a couple of decades ago, they would pass the trash. They would send the teacher down the road, usually to a different city, oftentimes in Washington State, and say, here's this teacher, and the other school district would hire the teacher. And in many cases, the teacher did the same kind of bad stuff that they had been doing in the original school district. They were just passing the trash on to somebody else without a warning. But in this case, it was the same district. The Seattle district knew the background of this teacher and decided to hire her not a decade later, but a year later, to say we're going to bring her back on board and put her into the same position. Now, I want to know who in the Seattle Public Schools got fired for that decision. Can you imagine if you worked for a private company and you decided to hire somebody that you knew was dangerous to the clients or their fellow coworkers at a private company? If you made that decision and you knew what the background of that person was, or should have known. I mean, should have checked their background. If they used to work for the schools, you say, what was your last job? Oh, I worked here at Seattle Schools. Well, what happened? I got fired. What's the next question? What did you get fired for? And if you got fired a year ago, why would we ever want to bring you back? And Seattle Schools did not do that. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.